You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, my guest is USA Today and international best-selling author Eliza Knight. Eliza writes historical fiction and historical romance novels, and she's the author of over 40 books, including The Mayfair Bookshop and starring Adele Astaire. Eliza's love for history began as a young girl, and she has been a history buff ever since. In addition to all of her books, she's also the creator of the popular historical blog History Undressed, and she's the host of the History Books and Wine podcast. In our conversation, we explored Eliza's career, creative process, and so much more. Eliza shared a behind-the-scenes look at how she brainstorms new ideas, ways to create more exciting sentences, how she develops really interesting characters, and the process she used to collaborate with five other award-winning authors on a very unique project. If you've been listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp for a while now, then you know I am a big believer that storytelling is one of life's most important and underrated personal and professional skills. Storytelling is a powerful tool to form deeper connections with others and communicate ideas that stand the test of time. This conversation that you're about to hear can be a stepping stone for all of us to become better storytellers in our own lives. I am really excited for you to hear it. So let's pull the tarp and get straight to best-selling author Eliza Knight. I'm excited to dig into your entire career and all the work that you do. You're prolific. You've written so many novels. I want to begin with, what's your first memory of storytelling and writing? Can you remember the first time that you really told a story or wrote a story?
Yes, I actually have a very vivid memory. I think it's from kindergarten. And I would take, like, do you remember the pieces of paper that it was like half for drawing and then half for writing on the bottom? And I would poke holes in the side and I would sew it with yarn and then like making a little book. And I would just draw like princesses and castles and create these stories during our, I guess it was like free writing time. I have that pretty vividly in my memory still of doing that.
What do you remember about that? Like that you particularly enjoyed? Like what were you so fond of that experience?
I think just like exploring my imagination. I always had a very, very large imagination. I used to like pull my covers over my head and pretend I was like in a spaceship and I would like just be like traveling through space and I would see things which were clearly not there. So I think just being able to explore different stories and making things up and like leaving this world for another world that I wasn't a part of, it was completely made up and imaginary. So I think that was just the fun of being inside a different world.
To that end, have you always enjoyed books and fiction, even from an early age?
Absolutely, yes. Apparently, I wasn't much of an early talker. And then like one day just came up to my parents and I was like, can you read me a story, please? And they were like, whoa, wait a second. We've never heard you say a sentence before. That was like the first sentence I ever said. So I've always loved books and I'm still like a voracious reader to this day. So yeah.
People say that whether it's authors that I've talked to, you know, who write fiction or nonfiction or screenplay writers in Hollywood that I've talked to, people say to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader first. And do you fundamentally believe that?
I absolutely believe that. In fact, I teach other writers. And one of the things I always say is, your homework is to go read a good book because you can't be a good writer if you're not a good reader. Because even when we're reading, there's just something about the sentence structure and the way people put words together that sparks things inside our own brain. And I'm a huge audiobook fan, but I have to also continue reading on paper because listening to a story is awesome and fun. And I like to do that just for the enjoyment of it. But when it comes to homework and training the brain, actually seeing those words on the page, I think makes a big difference.
So what do you recommend when you tell the students to read? Do you tell them to read something that Is it a particular genre that they're working in to read an author that is stylistically very similar to them, or go way outside the boundaries, or does it not matter?
I think it doesn't matter. It's really for preference. I personally like to read all genres, even nonfiction. I'm a huge nonfiction reader, just because I think we can learn things from other people's experiences, and also different writing styles can teach you something about your own writing style, or maybe something you might not have thought about before. When I'm writing a book, I typically don't read whatever genre it is that I'm writing, just because I don't want any sort of outside influences coming in. But once I finish a book, then I'll go pick that up just to read it and see what's popular. You know, if there's a book that goes viral or something like that, I definitely want to read it and see why.
What is it about? And I am, as I've said many times before on this podcast to authors and creatives, songwriters, I fundamentally believe that being a great storyteller is one of the most important skills in life. You don't have to be a writer, like professionally, for storytelling to be important. What do you think it is about storytelling that for people who maybe aren't as effective at it, like what do you think the biggest challenge is to become a more effective storyteller?
I think that probably the biggest thing that helps people enjoy a story is connecting with the characters. So I think those emotional beats are really important. And if we feel like we can connect with the character or empathize with them or root for them or hate them so much, there's something about the emotional connection, whether it's a good connection or a bad one, that makes us really interested in the story. I mean, even for TV shows, for example, I don't know if you've seen The Fall of the House of Usher yet, but everybody in that show is terrible, except for one guy. But you're still like rooting for them because you're just connected to them, even though they're terrible. And I don't know, there's just something about it. But when I'm writing a story, I really try to dig deep into those emotions to hit a chord in a reader, no matter what character it is, just something that will make them like want to know more and get to know the person better, or root for them or hate them. Just those emotional beats are super important.
The emotional beats. My wife and I just finished watching Succession. I don't know if you watched that series, but we were talking about all the characters in Succession, and it was 4 seasons, I think about 10 episodes a season. So it was a lot. It was a lot of content. And every single one of the main characters, or even some of the like secondary characters, like you could spin off an entire show, like an entire series, and be really interested in it, Eliza. It was remarkable. So I'm curious, how do you, as a writer and as a storyteller, build emotional connection with a character, whether they're a good character or they're a good person or a bad person?
So first of all, you're the second person this week that's mentioned Succession. So I actually really need to go watch that now. So as far as the character, I really like to put myself inside their head. And it's a lot about the backstory, which doesn't necessarily always make it out onto the paper. So it's trying to figure out who they were before the story started, what is like a major issue that they had in their past, what's a lie that they believe about themselves, such as like, I'm not worthy or no one will ever love me, something like that. And who they knew in their life, what they've learned, all of those things. So kind of digging into their past to build up who they are now and how they might see the world for who they are right now. So, you know, someone who believes that they're not worthy is going to see the world completely different than someone who thinks they're the greatest thing ever. So I just really try to build them as a whole person first with a full life in the past, and then stick them right in that inciting incident and see what's going to happen. And as far as like the emotional stuff, I have a background in psychology. So I think for me, it just comes a little bit more naturally because I studied it for so long, but it's really putting myself inside that person and like tugging on the heartstrings and the fears and the desires and all of that, and making sure that it's out on paper and that every little thing they experience has a feeling to it.
Eliza, when you're talking about building up a character and creating a character, am I hearing you correct? I mean, you're essentially creating all this context and depth to the character that may never see the public eye. It may never end up, that context may not ever end up in the book, but you're creating kind of the full picture so that you can get into their shoes. Is that it?
Exactly. Because when I'm writing, I really do put myself into that person's character. For example, I really drive my family crazy because if they have some sort of accent, I'll sometimes start talking like that. And my family is like, please stop. We don't want to hear you talk in your terrible British accent again today. But I just can't help it because I'm just like in it so much. The other thing is, for example, the book I have coming out next year about Ella Fitzgerald and Marilyn Monroe, she was a very depressive character, Marilyn Monroe. And so writing her story often put me into some dark places, just thinking about how she would feel in certain situations. So it's very like empathic way of writing, I think. But I think it also brings like a fuller character to the page, or at least it's more satisfying for me to have them be like these rich, full people that I guess live in my head for a little while.
One of the questions I often ask authors, in particular authors who write historical fiction or historical romance, because historical fiction in particular is a genre that I really enjoy because I read a lot of nonfiction, but what I find about historical fiction is no matter what's going on in your life, historical fiction transports you to a different place in time.
Yeah.
And that is really neat. But I'm curious, with historical fiction, how do you balance staying true to some of the historical context and facts, but creating within those boundaries?
That's such a good question. I love when people ask that because I deal a lot in my historical fiction also with real people. So most of my characters actually lived, and trying to find a way to tell their story so that it's still enjoyable for the reader as an actual story versus just picking up like a textbook or something is always tricky because there's a lot of things they might have done that's boring, but also things that are really exciting. So it's the same sort of way that you might create a fictional character where they have an arc, the beginning, middle, and end of their story, and there's a journey that they're following. And I'll pick some exciting years in their life and try to fit those beats on a timeline and make them exciting, like forming it in some way that might be entertaining. And some of the stuff can't go in, and some of the stuff obviously has to be explored a lot more to make it like make sense, because real people do things that don't always make sense. And they're not here for us to ask, why did you do that? Why was that your decision? And so kind of trying to dig into their past to figure out why they might have made a decision, or completely coming out of my own brain about why they might make a decision. It can be tricky and fun, but fortunately there's also like a lot of letters and diaries and things like that I've been able to dig into to kind of infer what things might have happened. But I think I always go back to like the psychological part of it, like why they might have made a decision based on how they were feeling at that point in time, what's happening in their world around them, and stuff like that, I guess.
I love it, Eliza. Let's dig into your process and workflow a little bit, the creative process, because this is unique for everybody, and I'm always fascinated by it. So let's start with, like where do your ideas come from? How do you create an idea for a new novel?
So a lot of it comes in pieces sometimes, or it comes from a letter I might have read, or a little historical detail. So for example, I wrote this book called My Lady Viper, and it was about a woman in Henry VIII's court. She was actually the sister-in-law to his third wife, Jane Seymour. And people called her a viper. And in fact, this one guy wrote this poem about her that he called her a viper in the poem. And it was just this mean poem. And I mean, we're talking like 1500s, like it could have been like that mean tweets or something like that, but it was actually a poem that he wrote. And then his sixth wife called her hell. So she would walk into a ballroom and say, oh gosh, hell is here. So I thought, well, why is this woman so hated by people? She's called hell by this person. She's called viper by this person. There's not very much detail about her life. I think it usually stems from like, I find a piece of information like that and I want to dig in further and find out why this person was like that. So for example, in my book, starring Adele Astaire, I had been reading a lot of letters about my character, Nancy Mitford, from the Mayfair Bookshop. And in one of the letters, she said, oh, I just had lunch with this woman named Deli, and she is a delight. And she's talking about all these like gossip things. And I thought, well, who's Deli? So I went down to the little asterisk and it said, Adele Astaire's sister to Fred Astaire. And so, of course, my brain was like, first of all, didn't know Adele Astaire was even a person. I had no idea Fred had a sister. And second of all, why is she in London having lunch with this aristocrat? That's so random. And so I jumped down a rabbit hole. And that's usually how every story starts. It's me jumping down a rabbit hole from some little tidbit of information I found and then building a story out from that.
At what point, Eliza, do you know that this is an idea that you can develop into a 300-400-page novel? Is there a checkpoint where you say there's enough here?
Yeah. So basically, it's when I start obsessing over it for days and days, and I can't get it out of my head, and then scenes just keep coming to me, and I'll compile all of the scenes, and I think, okay, I think this actually can be something. And I usually will email my agent and ask her if she thinks it's viable, because she's literally a genius agent. And if she says yes, which is most of the time, then I just go for it, and I'll write like the whole proposal out, you know, plotting out the characters, figuring out their story, the timeline, and maybe even the first few chapters, because part of my process is learning who the people are, but I have to learn through telling their story. So for me, those first three chapters are super important to get to know the character, because I have all the things built out over here, but that's just like a form. And actually being in their head and sharing their experience is where I really figure out if it's like a character I can be invested in. Because if I'm not invested, then the reader's not going to be invested, right? So sometimes those chapters stay. Sometimes they're just part of the process and they have to be deleted. But that's pretty much how I figure that out.
What are you looking for? Or what do you think it is that about a character in particular, or about an idea that gets you to that state of obsession that you talk about, like where you're obsessing about it for days and you can't get it out of your head?
So usually it's someone who's super fascinating. I write a lot about women who are sort of outside of the box. So for example, in my book, Ribbons of Scarlet, I penned with a bunch of other authors. We were writing about the French Revolution, and one of the characters that I was writing about, she is a woman from the 1700s, a very young woman, early 20s, who lives not in Paris, but decides that she is going to travel to Paris on her own, which is not heard of back then, and she is going to assassinate this guy who is the owner and writer of a terrible newspaper who is inciting violence in Paris. And I thought, well, that is wild, because what would she, like, I got to know about this girl. Like, what made her think she could do that? And how did she go about it? And how did she complete her task? So mostly it's, you know, women in history that are doing amazing and fascinating things. And when I say amazing, I don't mean murder is amazing, but you know what I mean? Like the fact that she
I got you.
Let's go to that. So they're usually just like really fascinating people that I want to explore. And I feel like their stories haven't been told. So I want to share that with the world. And then if we're talking about my corgi book, which is what I call it, the Queen's Faithful Companion, I'm obsessed with dogs. And I love my dogs and I love other people's dogs. And I always wonder, like, what are dogs thinking? And I love the fast, like, people's relationships with their pets are so vast and different and interesting to me as well. So the reason for that book was really, I mean, obviously I was interested in Queen Elizabeth II's life, but really I just really wanted to be able to explore her relationship with her dog and other animals, because she was known throughout her life as being a huge animal lover. I mean, even when she was a little girl, there was a book published with her and her sister with their family pets. And then all those years later, before she passed away, she was still having all of her corgis. And when she did pass away, they were worried about where are her corgis going to go. So that to me was interesting, just like the lifelong fascination with dogs and the loving relationship that she had with her pets. So I think my ideas are really a lot about people themselves and their relationships with other people, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And the Queen's Faithful Companion, that's one I can't wait to read to see how you, and I know it's coming in June. I'm curious, you mentioned Ribbons of Scarlet, and that's a book that you co-authored with a number of best-selling authors and award-winning authors, Kate Quinn, Heather Webb, and others. I have got so many questions about that, because it has to be hard enough to write a book yourself. It has to be challenging to write a book with a co-author, right? Because you've got to get on the same sheet of music. How do you write a book with four or five people working together?
Yeah, that was such a great process. So there were six of us. And what we ended up doing was we each picked a fascinating character in history that we really wanted to research and write about. But we also had to make sure that their lives interwove, because it wouldn't be a book if their lives weren't interweaving and we weren't seeing all the characters through every chapter. So that was a challenge trying to find that, but we were able to figure that out. And then we had an extensive plot and we each went through each other's plots to make sure that things were flowing right for all the different characters involved. And we had also a shared big document. So one of the funnest things that we got to do with that book was that if one of our characters was in someone else's scene, we would get on a Google Doc and write the scene together so you could have the dialogue between the two people and it would come off even more authentically. And then we also had a Gmail chat, like a Google chat, where we would talk daily just to ask questions. And some of us were in charge of research for different parts so that we weren't all researching the same thing. For example, my expertise was the guillotine, which is a little bit morbid, but if anyone had questions, then they could come to me and I would ask that. And so it was fun. We called ourselves the Bastille Babes and just had a really, really good time writing that book and putting it out into the world. And it was a lot about, I think, having good friendships. We all knew each other fairly well before we started the process and respected each other's writing. So it made it even that more, I think, fulfilling for all of us involved too.
Where did the idea come from?
That is a funny question. Stephanie Dre and Kate Quinn and I used to write together every Monday at Panera. And I grew up going to France all the time because my grandparents lived there. And so I had kind of always had an obsession with Marie Antoinette. I loved Versailles. It was one of my favorite places to visit. And so anyways, we're eating baguettes. And I was thinking, man, we should work on a book about the French Revolution, because we had done a couple of other collaborations together too. A Day of Fire is about Pompeii, which is the explosion of Mount Vesuvius. And then we had done a book about Boudicca's rebellion. She was an ancient Celtic queen. So I was like, we should do a book about the French Revolution. It would be awesome if we had all these female characters. And so that's basically how it started. We were like, sounds excellent. Like, let's put this together. It took a couple years before we were actually able to start writing because we had other projects, but it was basically over eating baguettes and our joy of French culture and history together.
That is so cool. You never know what's going to happen when you hang out with some friends and colleagues at Panera or a coffee shop. You just don't know. So getting back to your process again, Eliza, so you kind of write those first three chapters or so, they may stay, they may go. Take me from there to like the end of the first draft. What does your process look like? What does a typical day look like? Take me through that a little bit.
Sure. So I start writing every morning around 6:30 and I do it in sprints. It's timed writing. So typically between 15 and 30 minute sprints. And I usually do it with friends. Madeline Martin is one of the people I sprint with in the morning. And it keeps you accountable to another person for your word count, which is important because if not, I might just be surfing the internet all day or reading books or doing something other than writing. So I usually do that. And I can only write in the morning. I'm a morning creative. And once it starts to get to be mid-morning, my brain starts wandering and I'm done for the day. So that's one of the reasons that I start so early. But my first drafts are actually quite hideous. And no one is allowed to look at them. They're very bare. So I feel like I write sort of like the way you might build a body. So it's very skeletal, like all the structure and stuff is there, but there's no meat on the bones. There's no fat or skin or anything like that. It's just very bare. So then my second draft, I go back and it's a lot more layering. So a lot of the descriptions going in, a lot of those emotional beats. And then I'll go in again after that, and I try to make things sound good. So adding some rhetorical devices, making sentences look a little prettier, tightening up stuff because I can be wordy. That's basically it. And then I have to read through it one more time at least just to make sure it flows right, because after you're like doing all this surgery to it, it could be really disjointed in some places. And then I'll usually send it to a critique partner for them to read it and let me know if it's garbage or not. And then off it goes.
Eliza, you know, I'm a big fan of Jerry Seinfeld and his comedy and obviously his work in TV for so many years. I've studied him and it's interesting how he looks at writing and feedback. And I'm wondering if this resonates with you. So Jerry Seinfeld will write for an hour every day.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a rule of thumb that he does not share what he wrote that hour with anybody for at least 24 hours.
Yeah.
Because he's writing smaller comedy bits and different ideas. And his theory is that if I write for an hour and then I walk out of my house and I walk to the coffee shop and I say, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And somebody says, "That's the worst joke I've ever heard." It's demoralizing and it essentially takes away the good energy that you created by committing to the idea of writing for an hour and completing the hour of writing. Is that how you think about it? I know you said your first drafts are hideous. I'm sure they're better than you say they are. Do you want to kind of be joyful in the fact that you committed to something and you did it from like a word count perspective and not get that negative feedback like Jerry Seinfeld's trying to avoid? Or you just want to let it marinate a little bit?
I think it's a combination of all those things. Like, I definitely don't want to get negative feedback because that feels really crappy. But it's also sort of like the enjoyment of it. I was very excited about what I was writing and I see all these things in my head. But then when I go back and look at it, say the next day or the next month, I'm like, oh, that did not come out the way I thought it was coming out. So part of it is that before I let anyone else read it, I want it to look good. Like, I'm a little bit of a perfectionist. So I don't want anyone to be like, oh, wow, she's off her game. So it's kind of like that too. But there is something in the enjoyment of having written something that no one else has read yet and kind of being able to say like, hey, guess what? I wrote a new chapter today, guys. I can't wait for you to read it in a year or whatever it is.
I love it. You've told me about something that you call a walk and plot that you do with Madeline Martin, your friend and fellow bestselling author who has been on this show before. I'm curious, walk and plot, you go for walks, you talk about different plots and different ideas. How does it work?
We do this a lot. It's actually one of my favorite things for plotting. So if the weather's nasty, I'll get on my treadmill, but it's usually nice unless it's winter. And we'll walk around the neighborhood, but we just put in our AirPods and we hash out any sort of issues we're having with plot. Or we might say, hey, do you think this idea has merit? And then spit it all out and then get ideas from each other or tweaks. If I'm running into an issue where I'm like, I just don't know how to solve this problem, or I'm not sure how to make this character more intriguing, something like that. So pretty much like it's a way to spit out everything that you're thinking in your head and get some feedback from it. And sometimes it's not even necessarily that I need advice or that she needs advice or anything like that. It's just being able to talk it out. It's like any sort of problem that you're having. Sometimes if you just talk to another person and they don't even say anything, you figure it out on your own anyway. It's just that need, like someone else hear you say what's in your head and if your idea is valid.
Eliza, I'm curious. I mean, it's certainly evident that you put a lot of thought into everything that you do and how you develop your craft. I'm curious, now you've written so many books, such a prolific author. What would you say is the area that you've grown as an author the most from one of your early novels to the one that we'll see in March and June?
I think the area that I've grown the most, man, that is a really difficult question. I want to say it's probably the more exciting sentences, or like the way I say something is a little bit more exciting. When I first started writing, I might have said, she smiled or something like that. And now like I describe what that smile looks like, you know, the kind of smile that is gutting or something like that. Like just a way that I think I just say things in a much nicer way. And I definitely write way better than I speak. So take that into consideration, guys. But I think it's just like the way I say things is a little bit more exciting and intriguing, I think.
And I'm curious, Is that what really is the key to like what you said earlier about developing a character? Like, I almost want to phrase showing instead of telling.
Yeah.
Comes to mind. Like, you're trying to show the reader as opposed to tell the reader.
Right. Like, I really just want the reader to be able to experience the character's story like they're there in the book, or maybe even they're the character, you know, versus watching something happen, like to be actually involved in the story.
I love it. I'm learning so much. I'm taking notes. I'm curious. I know that you've benefited a ton from writers' retreats and critique partners and plot and walks with Madeline and others. How do you avoid the challenge that so many people face in any industry, in any craft, of comparing themselves to others? How do you avoid the comparison with others?
So that is something that a lot of people do. They compare their success. They compare how many words they write a day to how many other words other people write. And I think that the biggest way to sort of avoid that is just give yourself grace and also acknowledge that you're doing something awesome too, no matter what it is. So if I write 50 words today, that's awesome. If I decide not to write today and instead just read a book, that's also awesome because reading is important for writers. So I think just trying to give myself permission to just be myself and to be excited for where I am in the process and not worry about what other people are doing, because no two people or their career is ever going to be the same. And if you try to compare yourself or say, man, I wish I was there, you would literally just drive yourself crazy.
What would you say as we get ready to wrap up our conversation? And I could ask you questions for the next 5 hours, Eliza. I've got so many. I'm curious, if you have to boil it down to one or two things that really have powered your success, what would you say those one or two things are?
A word comes to mind, and that's grit. I am also a workaholic. I don't know how to not work or create. And I just never stop. Like, I am very determined. I have a lot of goals. I'm very goal oriented. And I just keep working towards that a lot. And for some people, when you say like, oh, you're a workaholic, that sounds exhausting. It can be exhausting, but the job that I have is not exhausting for me because it feeds like my soul, I guess. So it's very enjoyable. And I get like pleasure from it and excitement from it. So it's not as tiring. The most tiring part of the job is really just like, I guess social media is exhausting. I would rather not do social media so much. But yeah, I think it's just that I have a lot of grit and determination. And I think that's it.
When people say the word workaholic, you know, it gets this negative connotation. But I think for people like you, and I know like for me as well, and a lot of the work that I do, when people look and say, you know, it must be exhausting, I say, you know what, it's fulfilling.
Right, yeah.
And I feel this immense sense of gratitude that I get to put a lot of energy behind things that give me great, great passion and drive me forward. I'm curious, and I spend a lot of time thinking about this myself, and I don't think I've gotten to a complete answer, even my own story, and kind of what the core motivates me and drives me. What do you think motivates and drives you really underneath it all?
I don't know. It's sort of like just ingrained. So I get very like, I could see something and I'm like, oh, I need to learn about that. And I just get sort of like these obsessive moments where like I'm just digging in and I want to learn everything about it. I'm going to watch every documentary about it. I'm going to read every book about it. And that is what drives me, I think, is just my desire to learn and to grow as a person and then to share that with the world via story, whatever it is. I think it's just those passionate like interests in humans and in life.
I love finding a rabbit hole and going down as far as I can to learn everything I possibly can about a subject or a person. Eliza, I have had so much fun. Thank you for getting me kind of behind the scenes in how this all works for you and how you put this all together. I know you're in many ways, you're just getting started. You have a new book out. in March. You have another book coming out in June. I can't wait to continue following all of the work that you put out into the world. Thank you so much, Eliza Knight. It's been wonderful having you on Everybody Pulls the Tarp. You are a certified tarp puller, no question.
Yay, I'm glad to be here. And this was really, really so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of tarp pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today's a great day to pull the tarp. I am rooting for you. See you next time.